Welcome to Forever Giants, the podcast. I'm Rennell Brooks Moon. In today's episode, I sit down with Dave Dravecki at the beautiful Silver Oak Cellars in Napa Valley. The story of the San Francisco Giants is legendary. In my years as the official voice of the Giants, I've had the privilege to meet countless players and personalities whose passion for this team is only matched by their love for the game. Their stories are intertwined within the fabric of this team's history. They are Forever Giants.
And the pitch to Oster is swung on and missed, struck him out. Foul tip and held by Terry Kennedy. Strike three.
Dave Dravecki's story is one that motivates and inspires people around the world. It's a story of a man who chased his dream until it became a reality. Never the standout, Dave worked harder than most to become a professional baseball player. During his career, he would face challenges even bigger than baseball. Not by choice, but by chance. Dave's story is one of overcoming adversity time and time again. It's a story that he has told thousands of times as a motivational speaker, and it's a story that begins in Youngstown, Ohio. I am so pleased to be joined by Forever Giant Dave Dravecki. Thank you so much for joining me for this show.
It's my pleasure, Rennell. Looking forward to our conversation.
As am I. You know, we're celebrating the Giants' 60th anniversary in San Francisco, and we're just thrilled to have you as our first guest for this show, because although your time was brief with the Giants, your story obviously is so compelling and so inspirational. So we're going to delve into that a little bit and talk about your journey. But first, full disclosure from me, as you know, I'm a Bay Area girl, grew up going to Candlestick Park. And when you were traded to the Giants, my girlfriends and I, my gamer babes and I back then, full disclosure, we crushed on you very hard.
I love it.
We crushed on you so hard. You had like movie star,
well, you still do,
movie star, soap opera actor looks. We were very excited to have you join the Orange and Black.
Well, thank you. It was great being a part of the Orange and Black, trust me.
Yeah.
I'm flattered.
Well,
I'm flattered, so thank you very much.
I can't be the first one that said that to you. I don't believe that for a minute.
Well, I hear that from my wife all the time.
There you go.
At least I think I do.
So it's also really super exciting for me and almost otherworldly that as a fan of yours, you know, as a young girl and young woman, that now I've gotten to know you as a community ambassador. We've worked some events together. I've been able to hear you give some motivational speeches. So it's really, this is kind of full circle for me. So thanks again for being here with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, let's start at the beginning, because your story is so remarkable. And you started playing baseball as a child in Ohio.
Yeah.
8 years old, I think you started. But you played all kinds of sports, you and your brothers, you said.
Yeah, we were a very active family. I had four brothers at the time.
God bless your mother.
Oh my gosh. Yes, we don't even want to get into that because I can tell you some amazing stories. But they were so supportive of us. Yeah. You know, when we were growing up as kids, we were extremely active. When you've got all boys in the household, you know, it's one thing after the other. And baseball was something that was just huge for all of us. And so we started with that love. And my dad was our coach. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's really cool, I look back on that time in my life, and, you know, one of the things I appreciate so much about my parents was that they were my cheerleaders.
Yeah.
And they didn't try to live their dream through me. They really encouraged me to pursue whatever it was I wanted to do. And my dad said, Dave, whatever it is that you choose to do, work as hard as you can to be the best you can.
Yeah.
But he said, you know, more important than that, have fun doing whatever it is, because life is too short not to enjoy whatever it is you pursue doing. And that stuck with me throughout my life. And my dad's still alive at 87. I'm just so grateful when we're together. I'm always reminded of those words that came from his mouth when I was a little kid.
What a blessing. And yeah, you're both your mom, you say she was your greatest cheerleader. Your dad was, you say, your biggest influence in you becoming a baseball player. They really instilled in you some important values that really served you well throughout what has been a really remarkable journey for you.
Yeah, it has been absolutely amazing. You know, when you've got your dad there every day, when you're playing this wonderful game, and he's giving you everything that he can, You know, one of the things that was so special, you know, I'd want to play catch, you know, and so I'd sit in the driveway waiting for my dad. Would come home about 5 o'clock. He worked in a machine shop, and he was dirty. Every day he came home, he was greasy. He was cut up by the steel, the shavings from the steel, and he'd drive around the corner, and I'd be standing there tossing the ball up in the air, playing catch with myself until he got home so I could play catch with him. And I'll never forget, I would look at him, and he'd come around the corner, and he'd see me in the drive, and all of a sudden his eyeballs would just go, oh no, here we go again. And he would pull in, and he was so gracious, he'd get out of the car, and he'd say, give me 15 minutes and meet me in the backyard.
Oh.
And that's where my dad taught me. He was the first one to teach me how to actually throw a baseball with control and to have fun doing it. And so he instilled that love of the game. You know, that's why the movie For Love of the Game, I love so much, yeah. Field of Dreams. All those things remind me of this wonderful relationship with my father that instilled in me that love for the game that I got the unique privilege of playing at the highest level.
What a huge blessing.
Yeah.
And you took that message with you every time you went to the mound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, Ronell, that I think has been so wonderful about my experience is, you know, when I got to the big leagues, I was still, you know, even though I was a big boy, I was still a boy playing a kid's game and having fun. I'll never forget when I was on the Padres, Gary Templeton, after 2 weeks of me being in the big leagues, you know, he looked at me. I was sitting in the dugout, and I was cheering, and I was screaming at the top of my lungs for my teammates. Just going, come on, guys, let's go, man. Go get them. Get it, you know, throw strikes. Let's go. And I was just into it, you know, and really passionate. And all of a sudden, you know, Tempe leans over and he looks at me like this. He goes, Dravecki, shut up. Be a professional. You're in the big leagues.
Wow.
And I was shocked. I thought, oh my gosh, I always thought this was a kid's game.
Right.
And I didn't know what to do. And he leans back over and he goes, just kidding.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
I was like, Tempe, you're killing me. So, yeah. And that's all because of my dad.
Yeah. That's so awesome. Well, let's get back to that journey. You started at age 8, and then you actually throw your first no-hitter as a teenager. Is that correct?
Yes. To be perfectly honest with you, I don't know specifically when it happened, but I did. I do remember at Youngstown State University when I was in high school. It was my senior year. I hadn't pitched a lot. Mm-hmm. I think I was 3-2 that season. In Ohio, you don't play very many baseball games. Mm. You know, so my coach came up to me after the season. He said, look, I want to tell you something, Dave. I actually think you have the ability to play at the next level, college baseball. And I thought, well, geez, this is great.
Did you think you had that ability?
I didn't know.
Mm.
I was just having fun playing baseball.
Right.
You know, I was the little league kid, now a high school player, and somebody said, hey, you can go to the next level. I thought, oh, this is awesome. The only problem was there wasn't one university in the country that recruited me.
Right.
And so I lived in Youngstown, Ohio, and I decided to walk on at Youngstown State, and I played for them.
You literally walked on because it was like 20 minutes away from where you lived.
20 minutes away. So I get there. Spring break rolls around. Dave decides he's going to Florida with his buddies. And the team was having voluntary practices at the gym at the university. Well, I wasn't there. So when I got back after spring break, I went up to the head coach, Dom Roselli, and I said, Coach, I'm here. I'm ready for my uniform. And he goes, Dave, I'm sorry.
Oh.
But I gave out all the uniforms, and we've just ordered a few more because some of you who chose not to be here missed out. I was crushed.
Uh-huh.
Lesson learned.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I was going to have fun with my buddies. I'll go play catch on the beach.
Right.
Work out on the beach.
Right.
And so I waited for about a week and a half to 2 weeks before I got my uniform. We're now playing, and we're playing the Akron Zips. I'm in uniform, and we get there, and he comes up to me, and he goes, second game, you're starting. It's a doubleheader. I said, oh, yes, this is awesome. I get to play in it.
So what you've dreamt of.
Yeah, what I was dreaming of. I'm in college now, and I'm just so excited, and all of a sudden, I go out, and it's a seven-inning game, because back then, doubleheaders were 7 innings, and ended up throwing a no-hitter. And it was so cool because Dom Roselli came up to me afterwards, post-game meal at McDonald's.
Nice.
And so we're sitting there, and he looks at me, and he goes, you know what, son? I think we're going to give you a scholarship.
Come on.
He said, now, I can't do that this year, but he said, the next 3 years are yours. And I just was so grateful. I went home, I told my mom and dad, because it was just really hard to, you know, back then it was $3,000 a year to go to school.
Wow.
But it was still hard to scratch those pennies together to make it work, and they were so excited.
They
that
must
I was
have been
gonna,
thrilled.
Oh, they were so wow. excited. And so had four wonderful years at Youngstown State. It was amazing.
And then the Pittsburgh Pirates come a-calling, huh?
Yeah, you know, my junior year, really interesting. 7-1, 0.88 earned run average. I'm leading the nation in Division II baseball. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get drafted after my junior year. And the newspaper in Youngstown was saying, I'm going to go in the top 10 rounds. Well, I got the head this big about, you know, I'm hot stuff.
Right.
I'm the top 10 rounder. I'm going to go, and this is going to be awesome. Well, we go into postseason play for the first time in the university's history. Dom Roselli gives me the ball, opening the tournament against Wright State University. To make the long story short, we got beat 26-1. I gave up 9 runs, and 8 of them were earned. And with every run that crossed home plate, Wright State University was calculating my ERA and telling me with every run I gave up. Talk about a humbling experience with many scouts in the stands were looking to select me in the top 10 rounds.
Yeah.
Well, obviously nobody came up to me after that. And so in my senior year, my last game against Clarion State, I went 7 innings, struck out 14, gave up 2 hits, and we won. And there's a Dodger guy there, and there's a Pirate guy there. And the Pirate guy says, we're interested. And from there, in the middle day of the June draft of 1978, I get a phone call, and my brother says, Dave, I think this is it. He answered the phone. And I go, oh my gosh, this is awesome. I get on the phone, and it's Murray Cook on the other line, the farm director for the Pittsburgh Pirates, saying, Dave, you are now the property of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and we have selected you in the 21st round. I was like, oh my gosh, that's, do I get any bonus money? Is there a bonus in this?
Yeah.
And I found out in the 21st round back then, they offered you a cup of coffee.
Well, there you go, there you go.
And they gave me $500 a month. But you know what, Renell? I didn't care. I was a Major League Baseball player. The first leg of my dream came true.
That's right.
And I'm like, here we go, man. I get to show these guys that I'm the next Sandy Koufax or Vida Blue, because those were my heroes growing up.
I know.
I love those guys. So, you know, that's when I began. 1978, I began my career with the Pittsburgh Pirates, and what an amazing organization.
Yeah.
Willie Stargell.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, and Omar Moreno in center field, and just, you know, you could just up and down the list, and obviously Roberto Clemente being a part of that organization.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, and so it was just really cool experiencing that.
You have told a story about when Willie Stargell came to minor league camp, and he said something to you that really resonated for you. Can you share that?
Yeah, it was profound. Spring of 1979, my first spring training in pro ball. And periodically they would have all the minor leaguers come together, and a big leaguer would come and speak to you. And I loved it. But when I heard William Stargell was coming to speak to us, I was floored. I was just like, oh my gosh. They brought, in my opinion, one of the greatest baseball players in the game to come and talk to us. I'm all ears. I'm a pitcher, but I don't care. I want to hear what this man has to say. And so he sat there and he said a lot of really cool stuff. But the one thing that stuck was he looked at every one of us and he said, guys, I want to tell you something. Every day I wake up and I put this uniform on, I get butterflies. The day the butterflies leave is the day I retire. And I thought, oh my gosh, he has just validated my butterflies, because I get them every morning I wake up when I'm in spring training. Every morning I woke up when I was playing the summer before, it was there all the time, and I wondered, is there something wrong with me?
Right.
And when Willie Stargell says it's okay, guess what? It's like E.F. Hutton, man. It's okay. So that was just amazing to me.
Your butterflies were validated.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
And I needed that real bad.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And you mentioned Sandy Koufax and Vida Blue as your two idols growing up. Tell me about them and the impact they had on you.
Well, obviously, both being left-handed.
Yeah.
I longed to be a left-handed flamethrower. That didn't happen, but both of those guys were. I loved Vita's kick. I mean, way up there.
Yeah.
And Sandy had a unique kick to himself, too, as well. But I think for the most part for me, it was Vita coming in as a young man. I think he was, what, 19 when he broke into the big leagues?
He was a kid.
And to be able to do what he did just said a lot about this guy's makeup. You know, he was just really focused. Sandy Koufax, I admired him so much for the commitment that he made to his faith on Sundays, not pitching.
That's right.
I admired so much the way this guy went about his game. So in the course of my career, you would think, being a Major League Baseball player, I'd have an opportunity to actually meet these guys.
Yes.
You know, one of the wonderful things about Vita, as one of my heroes, was I'll never forget when I was pitching for the San Diego Padres. We go into San Francisco, and guess who I'm facing? Vita Blue.
Of course.
My hero is on the hill against me.
That's crazy.
Against me.
Yeah.
And so I won't bore you with all the details because we actually ended up getting beat 5-0. But one of the most beautiful things about that story is, you know, for any pitcher in the National League, he's probably more proud of his hitting than he is his pitching.
Yeah.
And I actually hit a double off of Vita that day.
Oh, my goodness.
And every now and then I remind him of that. However, what I remind him more of is that he was one of my heroes growing up.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I just love that man. And he meant so much to me as a little boy following him. And so that was just really cool for me to have that experience. And quite frankly, to lose to Vita was perfectly fine with me.
It was an honor, I would imagine.
It was an honor.
Yeah.
It really was an honor. Yeah. Because I never dreamt in a million years I'd get to face my hero.
Yeah.
Sandy Koufax. I'm retired from the game. It's 1993, maybe 1994, when they played the Final Four in Charlotte. And I was invited to go and speak to a group of coaches down there. And we were given tickets to the Final Four games. And it was back when Arkansas was playing Duke.
Okay.
And so President Clinton was there, and all these dignitaries were there, and then celebrities were there. And so we saw security all over the Coliseum in Charlotte when we were there. And as I'm sitting on one side of the arena, and Jan is with me, I look over, and who do I see? Sandy Koufax. It was back in the day when I had really good eyes. I said, babe, you're not going to believe this, but Sandy Koufax is right over there.
Oh, it's all over now for you, right? It's
and
over.
She looks at me and she goes, well, why don't you go over there and say hello?
Uh-huh.
And I said, babe, I can't do that. This guy was a big leaguer. And wait a minute. You were too, Dave. It might be okay. So she said, go. So I start walking around and I got to the other side. And all of a sudden, this guy in yellow with security in front of him stops me and he says, sir, I'm sorry, you can't go any further. And the reason why is because we've got the president that's here, we've got a lot of celebrities that are here, and there's high security. You cannot go into that section. Rennell, I have never done this in my life, but I looked at that young man and I said, do you know who I am? My name is Dave Dravecki. I pitched for the San Francisco Giants. I was diagnosed with cancer. I was told I'd never pitch again. And 10 months later, I was standing on the mound pitching. Sandy Koufax is sitting over there. He's my hero, and all I want to do is go and say hello to him. This kid's jaw about dropped. And he looked at me and he said, well, buddy, with a story like that, go right ahead.
Off you go. Off you go.
So off I went. I was waiting in line because there were probably three or four guys that were talking to him.
Sure.
All of a sudden, it was my turn. And I did not know what to do. So I'm standing there, and he made eye contact with me. And I stuck out my hand and I said, Mr. Koufax, my name is Dave Dravecki. And growing up as a young boy, you were one of my heroes. And I just wanted to come over and say hello. Sandy looked me straight in the eye, Rennell, squeezed my hand, pulled me close to his face, and looked at me and said, Dave, how are you doing? I have followed your story. Is everything okay? I was overwhelmed. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, my hero knows about me. And to this day, as you know, I will never forget that story. Now, here's the beauty in that story. You know, encouragement comes in really small packages. It really doesn't take much to encourage somebody who's hurting or going through a difficult time. Those words were words of encouragement to Dave Dravecki.
Yeah.
Those words were an affirmation of who I am. And you know, in our culture today, we don't have much affirmation going around.
That's so true.
And we really need to affirm each other more.
That's so true.
And so I am reminded of that story and how beautiful it is in our life because of the encouragement that I needed at that time.
And Jan had to nudge you. You didn't even want to go see him.
Because I was afraid.
Nervous?
I was afraid to go talk to this guy that was like bigger than life.
I totally understand.
You know, I didn't want to, you know, invade his space.
I get it. I get it.
You
I
know?
Totally get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But aren't you glad you did?
Oh, I am so glad. Let me share one more story
yes.
with you. Joey Amalfitano. I love him. First of all, he's Italian. Who, you know, how can you not love Joey Amalfitano with a name like that?
Sure.
And so I'm in spring training as a community ambassador, and they asked me to share my story with all the minor leaguers. And so I went over and I prepared to, you know, get in front of these kids, which was extremely intimidating because, you know, for me, being in that area is sacred ground.
Mm.
You know, I'm a retired guy. I'm not a current player.
Okay.
And so it was just sacred.
I get it.
And so you step onto that sacred ground and you want to respect it. You want to respect every one of those kids.
Of course.
And they're from A-ball all the way through AAA and all the coaches are there. And I'm sharing my story and I tell that story about Sandy Koufax. I'm finished and I'm getting ready to walk out. And Joe Amalfitano steps out of the room for a moment and comes back. And he looks at me and he goes, I've got something for you. And all of a sudden, out from his back, he pulls out a baseball and he says, here, this is for you. I look down and it is an autographed ball from Sandy Koufax. And he is walking away. And I said, Joey, get back here. And he's got tears streaming down his face.
My gosh.
I gave him the biggest hug and kiss and said, I love you and you don't know what this has meant to me. And so that today in my office, that ball is sitting on my shelf with all my favorite players.
Wow.
Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, Dusty Baker, Orlando Cepeda, Gaylord Perry. There's a whole slew of them there. Barry Bonds, Bobby Bonds. I mean, they've got some of the greatest signatures on these baseballs, and Sandy Koufax is right there with them.
That is amazing.
Yeah,
what
really
a moment for you.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Another reminder of the wonderful gift of encouragement.
Yeah.
Joe didn't have to do that.
No.
And what a special gesture just to, I mean, he said, you know, Sandy and I are good buddies. I was thinking, Joey, can I come over to your house when you invite him over? I just want to hang with this guy, you know? But obviously I didn't do that because that would have been way too forward for me to go. So
you have had so many remarkable moments. That's why we were so excited to be able to sit down and talk to you, because your journey is so extraordinary. And then for you to share these special moments is so interesting and so very moving. Now let's get you to the Padres.
Yeah.
Let's get you traded from Pittsburgh to the Padres. Tell me about that.
That was really interesting. You know, I was actually working out with the AAA team in the spring of 1981. And you know, I was really excited. You know, AAA baseball, you're one step away from the big leagues.
Getting close.
There's a revolving door with pitchers.
Yep.
If I make this team out of spring training, things are going to look good. On top of that, Pittsburgh's, what, an hour and 15 minutes from Youngstown, Ohio? Being the big leagues with the Pirates and that close to home would have been icing on the cake.
Perfect.
And so all of a sudden, here I am working out with this club. And it was really cool. This really interesting moment took place because about a week before camp broke, a group of us were all sitting, you know, and after practice, you're always talking baseball. And one of the guys in the course of this conversation said, hey, if you never got to the big leagues with Pittsburgh, where would you want to play? We didn't know, and quite frankly, I didn't care because Pittsburgh is the only place I was thinking about.
Sure.
And so in the course of that discussion, he said, well, I heard if we didn't get to the big leagues with Pittsburgh, the best place would be San Diego. We're all sitting there going, why San Diego? And all of a sudden, this kid goes, I heard if you don't make it to the big leagues with the Padres, they're AAA teams in Hawaii.
Oh!
And we're all thinking, oh my gosh, would that be an amazing gig or what? And so, you know, we kind of put that to bed. Nobody really cared after that conversation. A couple days passed. Now there's only 2 days left for spring training to break, and I'm still with the AAA team. Practice is over. I'm in the clubhouse. I've just showered, I'm ready to go back to the apartment, and all of a sudden the farm director walks in and calls my name. And I'm like, oh no. I am either going to be traded or released, and I don't want this. I want to stay in Pittsburgh. And as he approached me, he said, Dave, we've traded you. And I was so disappointed. Mm. But as I've often said, I can't tell you how hard it was to hold back a smile when he said, we've traded you to the San Diego Padres.
There it is right there, right?
So now all I'm thinking is, Hawaii, here I come. And with that, he looks at me and he says, the Padres are sending you to Amarillo, Texas.
And I, that ain't Hawaii.
I thought, where on God's earth is Amarillo?
Yeah.
And somebody said the panhandle, and I said, oh my gosh, my geography is not good. What is that and where is it? And off I went to San Diego.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, Amarillo, Texas was a sweet, sweet place for Dave and Jan Dravecki.
Really?
It really was. You know, I went there with a fresh start. You know, here's the interesting thing about baseball. You know, somebody says they don't want you, so they trade you. But there's somebody who wants you because they've traded for you.
Mm.
And so there's this really weird transition that has to happen very fast in the mind and the heart of the athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that you're being pushed out because they don't want you, but now all of a sudden you remember, but there's somebody on the other side that does.
Yeah.
And so you move into that space and you go, okay, now I've got to show them I am the next Sandy Koufax or Vida Blue.
Yeah.
I got to do it all over again.
Yeah.
But I'm getting a fresh start, and that's good. New teammates, so it's a different atmosphere.
Yeah.
Eddie Watt is our manager. Eddie used to pitch for the Baltimore Orioles. He was a right-handed relief pitcher. Eddie was one of the first guys when they never talked about cutters, that was always a slider. Eddie was one of the first in the big leagues to throw a cut fastball. And so we got to that, to Amarillo. We started the season. I was 1-4.
Mm.
I was supposed to be showing my stuff.
Right.
But I was struggling. And one of the coolest things about that team was that we were a very close-knit group of guys. We got to know each other really fast. But Eddie and Betty Watt loved us really well. This was a guy that cared about his team, his players.
Yeah.
And so he invested in every one of us. He gave us everything that he could possibly give us to be the best we could be to advance from Double A.
Yeah.
And one of the things he gave me was the art of pitching versus just throwing.
Right. I read that you said he taught you how to pitch rather than just throw. Talk about that.
Yeah. He kept it simple. He said, Dave, the first thing I want you to remember is KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. He said, when you go up there, what are you thinking about, you know, when you face a hitter? And I said, well, to be honest with you, I don't really know. You know, I mean, I'm going up and I'm just going to try and get him out. I guess that's what I'm thinking. He goes, no. First pitch strike. Split the plate in half. Mm. If you know he's a first pitch fastball hitter, split it in half with a slider. Oh, okay. That sounds good. You sure they're not going to hit it? He said, trust me. So then he said, from there, your only other thought after that is get a guy out in four pitches or less. Keep it simple. You want to stay in the game as long as you can. You're shooting for 9 innings. The less pitches you throw, the better chance you got.
He taught you the mental aspect of the game.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what he did was, what he was able to do was transfer the mental part into this place here.
Mm.
Because it's with the heart and the mind that work together that you can create this, what we call game plan and passion for what you're going to do in that game. That's where I was able to know and trust my stuff enough that I could get guys out based on the information this man was giving me. And when I applied it over the course of an entire season, I went from 1-4 to 15-5, and I was selected the minor league pitcher of the year. And here's the other thing. It wasn't just me, because in the Texas League that year, the record for complete games by a starting staff in the Texas League was 46.
Mm.
Our starting staff, of which 3 to 4 guys got to the big leagues, Mark Thurman, Andy Hawkins, Tim Hamm got a cup of coffee up there.
Okay.
64 complete games.
Get out of here.
64 complete games. one of the coolest things about playing in Amarillo was when you hit a home run, you got to pass the hat in the stands after the game.
So
we had this game against the Dodgers, and we were losing really bad. And we came back, and we tied up, and we went into 14 innings. 14 must be that magical number.
Mm-hmm.
We went 14 innings. Aaron Kane comes to the plate, our teammate, hits a grand salami, and we win. That kid passed the hat and got more money than he got in his paycheck.
That's beautiful.
And it was so fun to experience that. But that summer was amazing because what happened was Eddie and Betty created something that, when I became a Giant, became very real for me.
Mm.
You see, Eddie and Betty used to have potluck when we were in Amarillo.
Okay.
And that he would bring as many of the team that he that would join us, along with wives and girlfriends, and we would all bring food. And we would spend that time together getting to know one another.
Community.
And he created a family.
Yeah.
A beautiful family. Do you know, to this day, I still communicate from time to time with his daughter and check in on how he's doing.
Oh.
It is just amazing what that man helped me to understand about the importance of 25 guys getting along. They don't have to be best friends. They don't have to hang out with each other. But when they're in that clubhouse together and they're between those lines, it's all about them having each other's backs.
Yeah.
And it's about creating an environment where we do this together. Not one person is responsible for a win or a loss. We all are. And that was amazing. And that's what I experienced when I finally became a Giant.
Your journey thus far, and then obviously as it continued on, but as you share your story, we always hear that baseball, the sport, is a metaphor for life. And you're sharing all of these life lessons that you've learned along the way. You're not even called up to the big show yet.
No.
But look at all these amazing life lessons you've already learned.
Yeah, it was amazing. And, you know, the other piece of Amarillo, which has been chronicled really well, and I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's where Jane and I became Christians.
Yeah.
And it was there that our faith, we began this journey with our faith. And I mean, you know, we'll end up talking about this, but little would we know how important that would be to them when we heard cancer.
Yeah.
You know, but it was that element too as well that really established a foundation for us.
Yeah.
Where we saw the importance of relationship. Because out of that foundation in our faith was where we realized how important people are. And how important it is to love well, how important it is to care, how important it is to encourage, how important it is to see yourself less than somebody else instead of greater than somebody else. Well, then you begin to respect your teammates for who they are and what they bring to the table.
Exactly.
And so that became a very important part of this journey that we began together with this newfound faith.
You established a team in real life, off the field.
Yes.
It's just as important as the team on the field, which, you know, prepares you for the team you need to build in life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the thing that's really, really cool about baseball. It's understanding the value of those relationships while you're playing.
Yeah.
Because you never lose them when you're away from the game.
Wow.
That's the one thing that baseball gives you. When you're out of the game, it keeps moving forward without you. But the one thing it gives you are friends.
What a gift.
That lasts for a lifetime.
That's a huge gift.
It is. And to this day, I can tell you, those guys that are still in my life,
yeah.
that have been a huge encouragement to me
yeah.
as I continue to live. And yeah. I will never, ever, ever forget the significance of what that means to me as a result of being a Major League Baseball player.
Well, let's talk about some of those guys and those teammates and managers that you've played for. Let's get that call up to the San Diego Padres, to the big show. Tell me all about that.
It was amazing. You know, here I am. We finally made it to Hawaii in 1982.
There you go.
Jan is pregnant and gives birth to our daughter, Tiffany, my little princess, who, by the way, is still my little princess.
Of course.
At 35 and has given me two more little princesses in Francesca and Georgia.
Beautiful.
And they're Frankie and Georgie.
Oh, come on.
It
with the cuteness.
I mean, they're the love of our lives.
Oh.
And I've got two little boys, too, as well, from my son and daughter-in-law. But Jan gave birth to Tiff, and it was just a sweet time in our life. I was playing in Hawaii. Life couldn't have gotten any better.
Yeah.
I'm now a dad, and a couple days after the birth, I'm getting ready to go to see Tiff and Jan, and all of a sudden the phone rings, and it's Bob Kluck, the farm director for the San Diego Padres, and he's congratulating us on the birth of our child. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is so cool. They care about me more than just being a baseball player.
Right.
That means a lot
right.
when you're working for any company, that somebody would care for you. And so I said, Bob, thank you so much. And he said, oh, by the way, I've got some more news. I said, what's that? He goes, you're going to the big leagues. I said, knock it off. I said, Bob, seriously, Dave, you're going to the big leagues. I said, Bob, I know how much you're a prankster. Is this a prank? He said, Dave, you're going to the big leagues. I said, Bob, are you serious? He said, would you like me to call up somebody else? I said, okay, when do I have to be there?
Wow.
Off I go. And I mean, I am just floored. I get to the big leagues. I pull into San Diego a day later. Jan comes 3 days later. The baby's 6 days old.
Wow.
And she meets me in San Diego. You're not going to believe this, but it was the Motel 8 or something like that that I got put up in. We're talking 1982 now, okay?
Well, you know, that was fancy then.
Yeah, yeah, that was fancy then. At least I was thinking it was fancy. It was okay.
Yeah.
But here we are in this hotel, and I'm like, where am I? What am I doing here? Do I belong here?
Yeah.
But I've got a big league uniform.
How about that?
And it was absolutely amazing. But I've got to tell you, the first 2 weeks of my career, Willie Stargell forgot to tell me that when you have the butterflies throughout the whole game,
oh.
it's not a good thing.
Okay.
And so I ended up, it just felt like every time a guy came to the plate, it was Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get him out.
Yeah.
To the point where one game I was pitching and Dick Williams came out. And Dick was a tough manager.
Mm-hmm.
Really tough. But I had a lot of respect for Dick Williams because he knew how to handle players. He knew the players he could go to the press and rip and they'd be okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the players he had to be face-to-face. He knew the players that he just had to say it publicly.
Yeah, that's a special, unique dance managers
yeah,
have to do.
It
good
really
managers
is.
Have to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we had some really good ball players during that period of time. Guys like Goose Gossage and Steve Garvey and Tony Gwynn.
Yeah.
Some great players. But I'll never forget him coming out to the mound. He looked at me and he goes, rookie, if you don't start throwing strikes, I'm sending you back to Hawaii.
Oh, my goodness.
And I stood there and I stared at him and I was thinking to myself, that might not be a bad idea.
Oh.
So we're in L.A. Jan and Tiffany were there. I go back to the hotel room, and she finally looks at me, and she goes, Dave, what is wrong? You've lost like 12 pounds. You're not talking. What? You love this game. What is going on? And for the first time in my life, Rennell, I looked at her, and I said, I'm scared to death. I don't know if I can do it up here. And she said, look, you know I didn't marry you because you were going to be a big leaguer. I loved you and love you for who you are. She said, you know, if we have to go back to Hawaii, that's not going to be so bad. But let me just say this. Why don't you go out there and just be the best you? You're trying to be somebody else that you're not. You can't be Sandy Koufax, Dave. You're not Sandy Koufax. And by the way, you're Dave Dravecki, and guess who they called up? Dave Dravecki.
Wow.
So go out there and be the best you can be, and if it doesn't work and we go back to Hawaii, that's okay.
Wow.
That's okay.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, this huge weight just dropped off my shoulders. And that night, for the first time in my major league career, I begged for that phone to ring in the bullpen and my name to be on the other end of it.
You were ready. You had a whole
I
new
was
outlook.
So ready.
Yeah.
And so from then, you know, it was history from there. I stuck.
She's like another coach for you.
Oh.
Jan.
Absolutely.
Right?
And throughout all of life.
All right, your big league debut, the moment you've been waiting for since you were 8 years old, 1982, as a San Diego Padre.
Yeah.
Were those Willie Stargell butterflies in that stomach? Was the family in the house? Tell me about that day.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I remember calling my dad, and he cried.
Oh.
And it was such a beautiful moment, and they came right out. We flew them out, and it was just a really exciting day, extremely exciting. And, you know, you never know because you're in the bullpen whether or not you're going to come in or not. But I remember my first appearance, to be perfectly honest with you, many times people have asked, do you know who you faced, your first batter? The answer is no.
No.
Do you know what team you pitched against? No, I don't. I was so overwhelmed by where I was at. I can't tell you. The only way I can tell you is if I go back or if you had the stats and you knew, you could tell me and then I go, oh, okay, that's cool. That's cool.
It was like an out-of-body experience
for
you.
It was. It really was. Yeah. And to the point of, you know, realizing that, you know, I was very intimidated by all of this and really questioned whether or not, you know, I could do this.
Were you good enough?
And so, yeah, am I good enough to play this game at this level?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that first day, I mean, I have no recollection.
Wow.
I remember a cab picking me up from the airport, and I remember having my gear with me, and that's about it. And then, you know, whenever that first day happened, whatever you say the day was, and whoever it was against, and whoever I was facing, thanks for the information.
I'll go with that.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's fast forward to the following season, 83, a great season for you, and you were named an All-Star that year.
Yeah, that was incredible. You know, in spring training, Rennell, I think every year, every spring for me, in USA Today, they had the top five pitchers in spring training and the top five worst pitchers and best and worst pitchers in spring training. I was always in the top five worst pitchers in spring training. And so in 1983, it was really bizarre that I had a horrible spring, but then I jumped out of the gates fast.
But that happens sometimes. Baseball is crazy like that, right?
Yeah, it really is. And I ended up being 12-5.
Yeah.
Selected to the All-Star game. And I'm so grateful they do it in the first half and not the second half, because the second half I was 2-5.
Not so great. Yeah.
And I ended up 14-10. But man, being in the All-Star game, I mean, you're in the locker room, and you've got guys like Johnny Bench sitting there and Pedro Guerrero. And I mean, all these great players, and on top of that, your buddy Atlee Hammaker is there with you.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and so some of the young guys that made it was just so cool. And then on the other side, I get to play against Alan Trammell, and I get to play against Jim Rice.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, some of the great names.
Dave Winfield.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
I mean,
it
is ridiculous. And,
yeah.
And here I was, and I go out there and I pitch two scoreless innings. And my claim to fame in the 83 All-Star game is that I struck out Freddie Lynn and George Brett. And George Brett to this day denies it. And the reason why I know he denies it, I was at a speaking event for Weaver Popcorn. I'll never forget this. Weaver Popcorn is the popcorn that is sold by the Boy Scouts.
Okay.
And so Mr. Weaver actually invited me to speak for his company. And while I was there, George Brett was actually at the hotel.
No.
And he happened to be at the front desk with Mr. Weaver. And Mr. Weaver says, hey, Dave Dravecki's in there telling stories about how he struck you out. There's actually a video where it shows him throwing a fastball and it's strike three. And George looks at him with the straightest of faces and says, that was not strike three, that was strike two, and he didn't strike me. You go back and tell Dave Dravecki.
That's beautiful.
So my claim to fame is George Brett and Freddie Lynn in the All-Star game.
It's a good thing you got Freddie Lynn, though.
Yeah, I know.
Then he was dangerous, yeah.
Yes, he was very dangerous.
Yeah.
But what a great honor to represent your ball club. Terry Kennedy and I were the representatives from the Padres.
Yeah.
And it was just a really, really special time. It was in Old Kaminsky Park.
Yes.
My dad came, and my mom and my brother, my baby brother, who at the time was probably 2 or 3.
No.
And there's like 20 years difference between the two of us.
Wow.
And so he got to experience that. So it was just really, really cool. 83 was a fun year.
Yeah.
It was a fun year.
Yeah. Well, let's move on through your time with the Padres and some of your teammates. And actually, you and Bruce Bochy were teammates.
Yes, we were.
In San Diego. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Buckethead caught me.
Buckethead.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Well, everybody knows about the size of his head. And back when we played, he was Buckethead. I remember in spring training, we roomed in Palm Springs for a couple of days. And, man, all he would play was Sweet Home Alabama over and over and over again. And I was like, Bruce, come up with some different music, man.
Yeah.
And I wasn't a big music fan, so I didn't lose any sleep over that.
Right.
But we had a great time. And I always thought, you know, he's just really quiet. He was just a really quiet guy. And yet, he was really cerebral, very smart, behind the dish, called a really good game. He didn't catch me very often. As he says, TK was the starter, Terry Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so on Sundays, he would, you know, he would fill in. And so anyway, just had a wonderful, wonderful time with Boch, But, you know, Tony Gwynn and I came up together.
Oh, my gosh. I just, one of my faves of all time for so many of us. Please tell me about Tony Gwynn.
He's amazing. He and Alicia were in Amarillo, Texas when Jan and I were there. Mm-hmm. So he was a part of that Eddie Watt team. Mm-hmm. When Tony first came to us, everybody was, there's this big hoopla over Tony Gwynn. You know, number one pick. And he's racing through the minor leagues and he's making a stop in Amarillo. And he comes in and he goes to the outfield, to right field, and they start hitting him fly balls and ground balls. And he starts throwing and we're going, what is this? You picked this guy in the first round? Are you crazy? I mean, he'd go get the ball and the next thing you know, it'd come out of his hand and we're like, come on down, come on down. Come on down. And he's trying to throw it to second base. And he's not getting it there.
Yeah.
He can't get it to third. He can't get it home.
Wow.
And we're like, oh, my gosh, what in the world is going on?
Who's this guy?
All of a sudden, they start taking batting practice.
Uh-oh.
And we're all shagging. And next thing you know, we hear whack, whack, whack. And we're racing around the outfield shagging balls off of Tony Gwynn. And we're all going, we could care less about his defense.
Yeah.
This is awesome. We got offense, man. And one of the most amazing things about Tony Gwynn was he had the most incredible work ethic of just about any player I have ever known. That man, when he got, the next year we both got to the big leagues. But in spring training before he got there, do you know what he did? He went specifically to Tom House, the pitching coach in our organization, who was Nolan Ryan's personal pitching coach towards the end of his career. Tommy was asked by Tony to help him throw a four-seam ball from the outfield because he kept grabbing it with two seams and it would dance all over the place and he never had the accuracy that he wanted. He spent that whole spring, Rennell, learning to throw out of his glove from Tom House a four-seam fastball. And all of a sudden, how many gold gloves later?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this kid was amazing. When he got to the big leagues, he was not the same guy we saw a year earlier.
Right.
And then he'd go down and take 150 swings before batting practice even started. This man would work on every aspect of his hitting and fielding that you could think of. And then when it came to running, he never had to work on any of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because this guy had such natural instincts for the game that his moving from first to third or from a base hit that looked like a single to second was just based on the God-given talent that he was given and those instincts that he kicked into gear. When he crossed between the lines, that man was a pure baseball player.
His work ethic was legendary, and I know a lot of players even respect him more for who he was off the field than on the field.
Oh, wonderful human being.
Yeah.
Wonderful. He and his wife both.
Yeah.
They were just sweethearts, and they were wonderful to be around. Obviously, in Amarillo, Texas, when we were with Eddie Watt, Tony and Alicia were one of the couples that would come. And, you know, for us, it was always great because, you know, if you're eating dinner with your wife in the minor leagues, it's one meal and it's maybe a hot dog and maybe some mac and cheese if you're lucky.
Okay.
But when you had the potluck night, everybody brought something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all love that. And that fellowship around that table was wonderful. And Tony and Alicia were a part of that. You know, as a major league ball player, he's Mr. Padre. His involvement in the community speaks for itself.
Yes.
Who the man was. This is the thing that I am, for me, this is the most important aspect of life, no matter what you talk about.
Of course.
It's not about what we did
yeah.
or what we do. It's about who we are.
Yeah.
You knew who Tony Gwynn was.
And the relationships that you formed.
Yeah.
yeah.
And the power of Tony Gwynn was in the person and his love for the game and his love for people. And he and his wife did that well,
yeah,
really well.
Yeah.
And so it was an honor and a privilege to be a teammate of Tony Gwynn's, along with some other incredible characters on that baseball team
yeah.
in San Diego, like Kurt Bevacqua and Champ Summers. And, you know, and then you had Steve Garvey, who was, you know, senator.
Right.
You know, and then Sweet Tony and Gary Templeton, one of the smoothest. You actually looked at Tempe playing shortstop and you wondered sometimes if he really cared because he was so smooth and so quick and so good that he didn't have to put in the effort that most players had to put in because he was that good.
Naturally gifted. It looked so easy for him. Yeah.
One of the best shortstops I've ever played with.
So good times in San Diego, you're living the life, you're living the dream, you and Jan are even thinking about your future and settling in San Diego, what you're gonna do after your playing days are over and being a part of the community. And here we come, July 4th, 1987, and you get traded to the San Francisco Giants, you and Craig Lefferts and Kevin Mitchell.
Kevin Mitchell.
All right.
Yeah, incredible. You know, another one of those moments where you're traded, which means they don't want you. And so it was really bitter when we walked into Larry Boa's office after playing a game in Montreal. And Larry said, Dave, go get Kevin and Lefty, and I want to see you guys. And so I did, and we walked into his office and sat down, and he looked at us, and he said, guys, I'm just going to cut right to the chase. We've traded you to the San Francisco Giants. And we were all shocked. Mm-hmm. The three of us just sat there, and we didn't know what to do.
Wow.
And Kevin was really upset.
Was he? Yeah.
Because he was born and raised in San Diego.
Exactly.
And he was so upset that he didn't want to go.
Yeah, I'm sure he thought he would end his career there too.
It was amazing. And so it took everything for Craig Lefferts and I to convince Kevin to get in the cab with us to go to the airport the next morning.
Yeah.
Because he was ready to go home. And so we literally had to persuade him to get to the airport with us and fly to Chicago to join the club in Chicago.
How'd you finally end up convincing him?
I think it was a matter of just words that we hoped would be an encouragement to him to realize that even though we're not wanted here, somebody else wants us.
Yeah.
And the other thing was just praying a lot that he would actually hear it and get in the car with us. It was like, because it was Boogie Bear.
Yes.
And you didn't want to mess with Kevin Mitchell, man.
Absolutely not.
You're one tough hombre.
That's
and
right.
So we were very,
right.
very gracious. And yet tried to be as firm as we could that we have no choice. We've got to go.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah.
So we finally arrive in Chicago. And when we get to the clubhouse, Mike Kruko stops us and looks at us and says, gentlemen, welcome to the San Francisco Giants. Giants, you are the final pieces of this puzzle. We are so excited to have you with us. And with that, Murph comes up and says, hey, Hum Baby wants to see you. Roger Craig wants to see you up in his office. So Lefty and Kevin Mitchell, is it okay if I say Boogie Bear?
Yes.
Okay, so the Boogie Bear and Lefty and I head up to Hum Baby's office. And when we get in there, Al Rosen's there, Norm Sherry, and Roger Craig.
Wow.
They tell us to sit down. And all of a sudden, Al Rosen looks at us and just says, gentlemen, welcome to the San Francisco Giants. And Hum Baby then says, you guys are the final pieces of this puzzle that we have been building, and we are so excited to have you as a part of the San Francisco Giants.
Wow.
And we're ready to go now.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go. And I got to tell you, it felt so good because, you know, here was this bitterness over being, you know, traded by this organization I thought I was going to spend the rest of my career in. But now I'm a Giant. And after hearing those words, it's like, I could care less about anything that happened back there. I am now a Giant. And gosh, Rennell, I've got to tell you, I had a horrible first half. I was 3-7. And I don't know exactly what my numbers were for the second half, but I pitched so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason why was because I love Candlestick Park. And I loved it when I was a Padre because every hitter hated hitting in Candlestick Park.
Yes.
And Hum Baby said, when we get back home, psychologically, you need to remember, Dave, this is our grounds. These elements are for us, and they play in our favor. And I looked at him and I said, Hum, you need to know something. I've always loved pitching here. You don't have to worry about that with me. Because, man, that second half of the season, I pitched my best baseball.
Wow.
And we go into this into the playoffs against the Cardinals.
Yeah.
And, you know, game two, you know, I get to start against John Tudor, one of the best left-handers in the game at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I throw a two-hit shutout. And, man, it was so exciting. Just on the mountaintop. And I'm a Giant. And I'm beginning to learn a little bit about the history of this organization. I've got teammates like Atlee Hammaker that I knew, Scotty Gareltz, Brett Butler. You had the Hackman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you could just go up and down the list of the players
Matt
on that
Williams,
team.
Robbie Thompson. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, just amazing. Bo Mel behind the plate and Bob Brenly. And mean, just an incredible team. Jose Uribe at shortstop.
And that was a special time, that Hum Baby era. And you guys, the 87, 88, 89, you guys were widely regarded as, you know, one of the great teams in Giants history.
Yeah, that was just a really, really cool team.
Yeah.
Really cool team.
Well, talk about the legend that is the Giants and putting on that orange and black and all the history that comes with that. You finally are settling in, and now you're really understanding what it means to be a Giant, yes?
To a degree, while I played, one of the beautiful things that helped to enforce that was in spring training in 1988, Willie Mays hung out in the clubhouse a lot.
Which he still does today.
I know. It is absolutely amazing at 86 years of age. And as sharp as he is, it just breaks my heart that he can't see well,
I know.
Because if he could, oh my gosh, there'd be nothing stopping that guy.
Yeah.
He's unbelievable. But to have him come into the clubhouse and get all over the pitchers as we sat there with our ice packs all over us, and he'd walk in and he would just be reaming us up one side down the other.
Just
you guys
and chops.
Are a bunch of sissies. And I mean, we just loved every minute of it because it was Willie Mays.
Yeah, you said he really used to get on Atlee Hammaker a lot.
All the time. He got on Hambone all the time. And Atlee and him used to go back and forth, jawing at each other. And obviously, Willie would always win. And Atlee loved it because this guy is San Francisco Giants.
Absolutely.
And you know, in my humble opinion, back then, being able to hang around him has made me realize today, now looking back, just how special that was. You really can't appreciate something until you're out of it for a while and you get a chance to look back and experience it, which is what the Giants have given me the opportunity to do as an ambassador, to experience it once again and become a part of that family. And now I know the significance of what it means to be a Giant because of the history and the tradition of an organization that has maintained the integrity of a game that is the great American pastime.
Mm-hmm.
And it's with guys like Willie Mays and Willie McCovey and Orlando Cepeda and Juan Marichal
and
Barry Bonds and Bobby Bonds and, you know, and the Rich Aurelias and the Rob Nens and the JT Snows and the Robbie Thompsons and the Mike Krukos. I mean, you can go from decade to decade to decade to decade and understand why this organization is so amazing. And for me, it all starts with the greatest baseball player that's ever donned a uniform, and that's number 24.
How lucky are we?
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
How lucky are we?
Yeah, you've used the word blessed a couple times in our conversation together. I feel so blessed to be a part of something that is so much bigger than any one person, but understanding that it's all those people that make who the San Francisco Giants are. You know, Willie McCovey celebrated his 80th birthday this year. And it was a privilege to be invited to go to his birthday because I'm a Willie Mac recipient.
Yes, you are.
And I got to tell you, Rennell, there is no greater honor than being honored by your teammates with what I think is the most significant award that any player can receive. And it's not because of anything that Dave Dravecki has done, but it's all about who Willie McCovey is.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a great baseball player. But in my mind, he's an even greater man.
Mm-hmm.
He really is. And I have had the privilege of just barely getting to know this man. But just spending time with him, I walk away feeling so much better about life.
Sure.
Because he's so humble.
Yeah.
And he's always talking about how great Willie Mays is.
Yeah.
And you know what? He was great, too.
Yes, he was.
He was great, too.
Yes, he was.
And he means so much to this organization. And, you know, those guys are the ones that started this thing.
You stand on their shoulders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they literally carry us. They really do. And it's because of them that I think we get the unique opportunity. You know, it's the understanding and the foresight of Mario Alioto and Larry Bear to see the significance of the past in this organization and how powerful that is as the present is being played out.
Yeah.
And to bring those two things together, all that can do over time is to continue to create these generational fans that go into the future. And that is one of the uniquenesses of the San Francisco Giants and being able to hold on to that fan base.
Yeah.
Because they understand the significance of who they are as an organization over 136 years.
That's right. That's right.
So
that's right.
And to be a part of that.
Generational fans, that fan base, you see it still today at games, 3-4 generations of a family at the game and passing that tradition down. You know, my mom was pregnant with me in 1958 when the team moved here from San Francisco. So it was passed on to me in utero, if I may say that.
Absolutely.
But that's why it's such a unique fan base, as I know you experience as a community ambassador going out and meeting the fans all the time. There's such a very special and rich connection that our fans have to this team that you can't say for other franchises. And you speak to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's another name that I want to mention, Will Clark.
Oh, the thrill.
Yeah. He was a teammate, and I'd take 9 Will Clarks any day, and I guarantee you I'll compete with you through the whole year, and you're going to have a heck of a time beating me in the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's guys like Will, guys like Atlee, that still stay connected. You know, I'll never forget, Rennell, when Will actually about a year and a half ago sent me a text. And he said, you know, Dave, he said, I was coming across this rummaging through some stuff, and I thought I'd share it with you. And it was a photo of Will and a group of guys behind him in the dugout in Chicago after I'd started going through my stuff. And what they had done is they had written me a note, and Will had taped it to the handrail on the dugout going out to the field. And it was just a reminder that these guys were wishing me well and praying for me.
Wow.
And Will was standing right there next to it. And he said, I thought you might like to see this. And I looked at it, over the text, I sent back a text. Oh my gosh, this is amazing, because what it reminds me of is the community of baseball players that I love so much, that meant so much to me during a difficult time. Would you please send me a copy? And he said, absolutely. And about a week later, I got the copy of that. And
Oh, that's so special.
Yeah, really special.
All right, well, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. 1988, opening day. Yeah. You're on top of the world. You're 32 years old. You're a San Francisco Giant. You're the opening day starter.
Yeah.
You've got a beautiful wife and family. You are on top of the world. You are living the dream.
Yeah.
Tell me about that opening day start.
It was amazing. You know, you can't paint a better picture. You got Chavez Ravine, Dodger Stadium, Dave Dravecki versus Fernando Valenzuela.
Come on.
I mean, it was amazing that
Classic.
Day.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we won 5-1 that day. I hit a double off of Fernando. He threw me that lazy screwball, and he hung it up and went off of the right center field wall. And, I mean, I was so fired up, and we win, and I'm thinking, man, I'm going to win 20 games.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, by September, I'm noticing this lump on the outside of my left arm.
So you discovered it.
Yeah. Okay. And it was obvious by this time. It had grown to about half the size of a golf ball that was sticking out of my arm.
Oh, my goodness.
So Jan and I were in an examining room waiting for the doctors to come back to tell us what they see on the MRI that I just had. Before they get into the room, and our door was open a few inches, they put the films underneath the lights, and they examined it first to confirm, just to be on the same page as to what they were going to tell us. And I'll never forget hearing the word cancer.
Had you and Jan maybe even thought that could have been a possibility?
No.
Not at all?
No, we were thinking this was scar tissue from throwing the baseball so much you tear muscle fibers and they can calcify. It's kind of like blocker's bruise in football.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we were thinking. And now all of a sudden we hear cancer, but they're not in the room yet. And so I just looked at Jan in those brief seconds that we had and said, we need to pray. And I don't wax eloquently when I pray, so I just said, God.
Nobody does. It's okay.
Yeah. And it's beautiful to know that God's okay, that you don't have to wax eloquently. Trust me, because my prayers are really simple. And this prayer was, God, I have no idea what we're about to face. But whatever it is, please give us the strength to endure.
Yes.
The doctors come in. They confirm, in fact, that I have cancer. I hear that, and then I go into a totally different space. I am there physically, but I am not there mentally.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, now I'm thinking about the things that matter most. I'm thinking about life. I'm thinking about death. I'm 32 years old, and I am now hearing the word cancer and thinking I'm coming face to face with my own mortality. And the first thought that came to my mind was, oh my gosh, if I die from this disease, who's going to marry my wife?
Oh my goodness.
And then I thought, that person's going to be the one that raises my kids. Mm. And then I thought, oh my gosh, well, this guy loved them as much as I do.
Oh.
But then, you know what, Rennell? The next question came in, and I was overwhelmed by it. Will this guy love them more than I do?
Mm. Oh my goodness.
Because I know who I am.
Yeah.
And I haven't been the best husband. I haven't been the best dad. And, you know, and the game gets you caught up in stuff. And, you know, it doesn't matter where you're at in life. This stuff just comes at you. And when it comes at you, it affects you. You know, you're having a bad day at the ballpark. You know, sometimes you bring that stuff home.
Right.
And so, you know, it was a real gut check. What are the things that matter most in your life?
All of that came rushing to your
all
mind.
All of it came rushing to my wow. mind. And then all of a sudden, I came back to earth. I was in that room, and I heard the doctor say, outside of a miracle, you'll never pitch again.
Mm.
And Jan asked them to say it two more times.
Oh, did she?
Yes, she did. It was almost like a test. Are you sure?
Right.
Outside of a miracle, he'll never pitch again. Like, you don't know my husband. But when I heard those words, I thought to myself, well, you know what, God? The doctors can tell me that, but I don't know what the end result's going to be. So, you know, I want to focus on my health. That's very important. But if I get to a point where I can actually start trying to come back, I am going to try. Because I don't want to walk away from this game and wonder for the rest of my life.
What if?
Yeah. Could I have been able to do the comeback?
Right.
I didn't. That's not Dave Dravecki.
Right.
I don't live my life that way.
Right.
So we're going for this. And I got to tell you, that 10 months was so hard. I ran into more walls and got bloody noses than you can shake a stick at. But 10 months after that, on August 10th, 1989, I am getting ready to stand on the mound in Candlestick Park. And when the doctor said, outside of a miracle, you will never pitch again, I was going to pitch.
There you were.
And I got to tell you, that moment was overwhelming.
I can't even imagine. I mean, what was that day even like for you? Could you, like, was the clock, like, moving really slowly? I mean, could you not wait to get on that mound?
You know what? As I think about that question, I don't know why, but I didn't realize the magnitude of what was going on.
Mm.
It was another day in the life of Dave Dravecki as a Major League Baseball player.
That's amazing to me.
And I walked out the tunnel, and what flipped the switch that this is something bigger than that, Dave,
uh-huh, uh-huh,
was when there were so many people down there from the press in the bullpen. The bullpen was packed.
It was like postseason
yeah,
media, right?
It was.
Yeah.
It was like World Series.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is just regular season, guys. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. This is something special. So I'm standing on the mound, and Terry Kennedy's at the other end. And I look at TK, and I go, I start patting my heart with my shirt.
Mm.
And he looked back at me, and he said, me too, me too.
Oh, my God, just pitter-patter,
so I'm like, yeah, I'm like, this is intense.
Yeah.
So I warm up, and I go, and I sit on the bench, and I'm ready for the game to start. And I remember walking out onto the field and standing on the mound, and all of a sudden, 34,000 people gave me a standing ovation. And I look behind me and I see, welcome back, Dave. And I was like, oh my gosh, God, you've given me a second chance. My dreams not only come true once, but twice.
You were able to take all that in that moment. You were able to be present in all of that in that moment. That's amazing.
It was amazing. And the first thing I said was, thank you. Thank you. And I was overwhelmed by that. All of a sudden, the umpire said, play ball. And all I was thinking was, I need to throw a ball so they can get the ball and take it out of the game. Nobody thought I should pitch.
Right.
And I'm standing there on the mound, and I'm going, how can I get the ball? So the first pitch was a ball. I do remember that pitch.
Yeah.
And the first pitch was a ball. And then from there, I threw 92 pitches, 8 innings.
Yeah.
And we defeat the Cincinnati Reds 4-3.
Yeah, not only did you pitched brilliantly, okay, in your comeback game.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Roger
Craig said that he didn't even manage that game. He just stood there and watched you in awe.
Yeah,
How about that?
The hum baby.
Yeah.
That was a really special day. Having Terry Kennedy behind the plate when the winter before he wasn't with the club and they actually made a trade for him. And I told my wife when that happened, and I was still in my comeback mode, I told Jan, I said, wouldn't it be something if I was actually able to make this comeback and TK was my catcher?
Come on. Come on.
And on that day when I went into the office to talk to Roger, I had never done this. I never requested a special catcher.
Right.
I went in and I said, hum, baby, I want to make sure TK's behind the dish today. He didn't say a word. He took the lineup card, pushed it up to the front of his desk, and he pointed. And there I saw Terry Kennedy. And I was like, yes.
I mean, you can't even script this, Dave Dravecki.
No.
You cannot have scripted that any better.
No.
So you pitched.
It was amazing.
You pitched this gym post game. What's going through your mind? Did you celebrate? What happened that night?
Well, the press conference was what was really profound.
Mm.
Because I don't know if you remember this or not, but there was a little boy, Alex Vlahos, was battling leukemia.
Yeah.
And I had met with him and done a press deal for his parents at Stanford Hospital so that they could get the word out for people to come forward and donate blood. They needed a bone marrow donor. And I never forget visiting with him, and he wasn't very enamored with me. You know, he didn't know. He's 6 years old. The little guy didn't know. And mom and dad were just so grateful that we could publicize this. And it was Dave coming back from cancer. We want Alex to come back from cancer. And it was so cool. But on the way in that day, I have to tell you, on the way in that day, I turned the radio on and KNBR is saying, we're going to have this deal where we're going to help Alex and his parents by asking the community of San Francisco to donate money for every pitch that Dave throws. You talk about pressure. So now, post game, I'm in the interview and I'm holding Alex in my arm.
Yeah.
I have the photo of that sits in my office to remind me every day of this incredible story that launched us into something later in life. But in that moment, I realized that, man, I was so grateful for the chance to be back on the Hill. And I was so grateful that over $200,000 was raised for this little boy. And quite frankly, Ronell, the bigger story in this comeback story was not my comeback game, but it was the story of Alex Vlahos.
Yeah.
Because he lost his life a year later.
Yeah.
But as a result, some 7,000 people in the community of San Francisco and the surrounding Bay Area came forward. And the last time that I talked to his dad, over 8 people through that blood drive, lives were saved. That is profound. And so standing there that day reminds me of how, you know, out of ashes can come beauty.
Absolutely. Out of darkness comes light.
Yeah.
And when you are blessed, you're able to bless others. And look what your experience did and continues to do for so many others.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of life.
It's been amazing. Yeah. It really has. And, you know, and 5 days later, you know, I mean, after this incredible game, I'm in the sixth inning against the Montreal Expos, and I rear back and throw the fastball that people have said was the crack heard around the world.
But before you pitched that night, you had a meal with your teammate Bob Knepper.
Yes.
Who said something incredibly profound to you.
Yes, he did.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I'll never forget this because, you know, pregame meals are really important for pitchers.
Sure.
You know, you want to get your carbs in, and I'm a huge Italian, so I'm going to have my pasta.
That's right.
And there were some good pasta restaurants.
By the way, can we get some pasta ordered for Dave later? Thank you very much, crew. No, go ahead.
So Bob and I are sitting there, and we're talking, and he goes, Dave, I hate to burst your bubble, but this is not about the miracle of the comeback. This is about the miracle that took place in Amarillo, Texas, when you met Jesus for the first time. And what God is doing is providing a platform for you through baseball to share his love with people who hurt. Ronell, that moment that I fell to the ground and I was laying there, after I caught my breath because Will stood over me and was encouraging me to breathe, Mark Latton ran out and said, breathe, Dave, breathe. As I got my faculties back, all I could hear were Bob Nepper's words. Now, it would take a couple years before all of that would sink in, but in that moment, I was like, oh my gosh, God, what are you up to in this story?
Because he had just said that to you hours earlier.
Yeah.
Come on.
Four or five hours earlier, I heard those words.
Yeah.
And when I heard them, I thought, well, that's great, Bob, but I'm in the saddle, man. I'm loving this being a ball player again, you know?
Yeah. You couldn't hear it in the way you needed to hear it.
No.
Until you threw that pitch.
Absolutely.
To Tim Raines.
Yeah. To Tim Raines. And you know what's really cool? I've got complete closure in that game.
Do you?
Yes, because 25 years later, the man that asked the bat boy to give him the last pitch that I ever threw sent that ball to me in December 3 years ago.
Just 3 years ago?
Just 3 years ago. He said, I have moved so much that I lost track of this because I was following your story, and I went to the ball game and I got a ticket right next to the Expos dugout, and when you threw that pitch, the ball rolled in there. I knew the bat boy. I said, give me the ball. And he said, I held on to this all these years and I just found it. And he said, I know, I think you're ready for it now, so I wanted to send this as a gift to you. This is the last pitch you ever threw in your career. Fast forward, I am now at the 2016 All-Star Game. We're at the pool at the Hilton, and we're just hanging out with some friends, and all of a sudden, in walks this man with his glasses on and a hat. Now, he's short enough to be Tim Raines, but I'm just not sure. And I looked at Jan, and I said, you know, I think that's Tim, but I can't tell. He's wearing glasses. I don't know if it's him. And so, all of a sudden, Jan says, well, why don't you go over and say hello to him? Another one of those, go over and say hello to him. And I'm like, Jan, I don't want to bother
him.
She
was always there to give you that
give me
nudge.
I don't want to bother him. And so, I got up, and I went over, and I said, Tim? And he turned around, and he kind of looked at me a little cautiously at first. But when I said my name, I said, Tim, Dave Dravecki, I just wanted to come over and say hello. He goes, oh, my gosh, Dave.
Wow.
How are you doing?
Wow.
I said, bud, you're not going to believe what has happened. And I told him about the baseball. And I said, now I'm meeting you, and I haven't seen you since that moment. I said, look, I'm not usually asking these kind of questions of celebrities, but can I have your picture? He looks at me. He starts laughing.
I can't.
Yes.
Wow.
I'll give you my picture. Absolutely. So his wife gets up and she gets over and she goes, oh, this is so cool, Dave. Yes, Tim's going to take a picture with you. Tim, get over there. And all of a sudden the twins come and they jump in front of us. And she's like, no, okay. I said, no, it's okay. Well, they can be in the picture too.
Oh, my goodness.
So we take a picture and then she says, girls, get out. And then she took a picture with me and Timmy. And so now I have the ball and I have a picture with Tim that are post-career that kind of bring full closure to that game in my story. And
that's remarkable.
I'm so grateful for that.
That is
so grateful.
Just remarkable.
You know, I don't very often get a chance to share that story, so thanks for asking about it.
Thank you for
sharing
that story.
It's
just super remarkable. That's amazing.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk a little bit about overcoming the adversity of that journey.
Yeah.
Going through cancer twice and having to battle it twice. And I know you've been very open about how difficult it was for you, that you were depressed and you had a lot of anger issues. And can you share that, as you've shared with so many, which helped so many people around the world overcome their own adversity? So talk about that part of your journey.
Yeah, that was an extremely difficult time in life. You know, we were really at a dark place. We were
both you and Jan.
Both Jan and I, and for Jan, it was much deeper, because she was trying to now, after I had to announce my retirement from the game, and the cancer came back, and we went through the process of all the surgeries, trying to be everything to everybody. When we retired, we had in San Francisco our apartment had a single car garage. And as a result of well-wishers and people praying for us and cards that were sent and letters that were sent, the entire single car garage was full of mail. Mm. And we felt compelled to respond to all of it. And so a bunch of people stepped in to help. The Giants, an organization called Insight for Living that handled all the serious suicidal counseling letters that we received, because people were just pouring out their hearts. It was overwhelming. And then publishers wanted us to write our story, and we're in the midst of this, and it's just coming at us and coming at us and coming at us. And so much of it was good, But I was just not ready to handle that.
You couldn't even catch your breath.
Physically,
yet.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Jan was trying to be everything to everybody, and so it all kind of culminated with this amputation. And I thought, if we could get rid of my arm, we could get rid of all my problems.
The arm that gave you your career.
The greatest
and
joy.
Your life.
Yeah. Was now gone. And I thought, but if we can get rid of this, maybe I can get rid of all my problems. Mm. And that's when the darkest of the darkness began, because I went into an identity crisis. Who am I if I can no longer be a pitcher? What am I going to do as an amputee? Who's going to want me to be able to work, to provide a living? I didn't make the kind of money that warranted us being able to retire and walk off into the sunset after this. So I had to work to provide a living for our family. And so as a result of that, it became extremely difficult. And I had stuffed a lot, Ronell. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how to articulate that.
Right.
And so as a man, I realized that if I showed any weakness, then I was done.
Right.
And so I had to be strong. And I actually found out that strength is really in weakness. And but in order to get there, I had to get worse, because I became verbally abusive to the people that I love the most.
You didn't know what to do with your emotions.
I didn't know how to communicate what was going on. I didn't know how to articulate my pain. Jan was really good at that. I was horrible. And unfortunately, the people that I love the most, I was the hardest on.
Of course.
And, you know, I don't say this as an excuse, but for me, they were safe.
I understand.
And yet at the same time, that is no reason to ever treat a woman like that, to ever treat two little kids like that. Was horrible.
But it wasn't even really you. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It wasn't you.
Yes. Because it was the result of all this pain that I stuffed, because I didn't know how to talk about that pain. And in the talking is the healing. And so eventually we finally moved to a place where I was willing to say to Jan, if you're struggling that much, I was still in denial, Ronell. Mm-hmm. If you're struggling that much, then I will support you and we'll go get counseling. Mm. And we moved into 18 months of counseling. We both got on Prozac. We call it vitamin P.
Okay.
And so it was an incredible tool in helping us to heal, along with going into our story and finding those places that needed to be reworked, mm-hmm. because they were very unhealthy. For 18 months, the gift that God gave me was to actually learn how to communicate to the most amazing woman in my life.
That's one of the bravest things you can do is go to therapy and figure it out.
And what I experienced, when people say and talk about God's grace, I actually experienced it firsthand through an amazing woman named Jan Drabecki.
That you did.
And so as a result of that, when we were done with the counseling, we had moved to Colorado to get a fresh start. And while we were there, she had received a book that she was asked to endorse, dealing with men and their anger. How ironic is that?
Yes.
And as a result of that, Ronell, she came to me and said, I would like for you to go to this counselor who specializes in anger. Mm. Are you willing to do that? And I was so healthy at that point, I said, honey, absolutely, I do not want to be this man anymore.
You had done the work, so you were able to receive that from her.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so she gave me that gift, another gift.
Yeah.
And for 12 months, I went into anger management counseling. And it really wasn't anger management, it was freedom from anger.
Mm-hmm.
It was freedom from anger, because I think my wife would tell you today, it's been about 22 years since Mount Vesuvius erupted.
Mm.
And gosh, that feels good to say.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we got on a healthy track. And it was so good. It was so freeing to be out from underneath all of that stuff.
Yeah. It had weighed you down.
Yeah.
How could it not?
Absolutely.
It's way too much. And then you took all of that work you did, and the two of you have been on this wonderful, remarkable crusade and journey to share your story with so many others and the lives that you have touched. Talk about you as a motivational speaker and an author now, and how you two worked that into your lives.
Yeah, you know, it's been amazing. When those people started writing to us, little would we know or realize, along with Alex Vlahos and his story, that that really was the birthing of what would become Endurance with Jan and Dave Dravecki. And it's the opportunity that we have been given through our pain and suffering to come alongside others who hurt and simply just to love them in the midst of that journey the way God would love them. Mm-hmm. And so we often say we're the garbage dump for people who are in the midst of pain.
Right.
Because we needed a garbage dump.
Sure.
I needed a garbage dump. And
yeah.
Because I didn't have one,
yeah.
I ended up going through what I went through. So we saw the value of being able to dump stuff. So we let people dump. And then in the midst of their dumping, there's no judgment. There's no criticism. There's no condemnation. There's only love.
We all got stuff.
We all got stuff. And so what we have been able to do for 28 years is to just simply, through our story, come alongside people and love them in the midst of their pain. And we do that by offering the what we call our encouragement gift box that basically has our story in it,
yeah.
Book form. And we send those off with a couple of mugs that have Endurance on it to remind them to endure the journey and that somebody else out there loves them even though they don't know them. Speaking, my gosh, girl. I'd have told you after 5 years of doing that nobody else would want to hear my story anymore.
Oh, are you kidding me? Please.
And here I am, 28 years. My years might be messed up, and Jan obviously reminds me that my details aren't very good.
That's all right.
But somewhere in that neighborhood,
yeah.
I have been telling the same story.
You've been telling the same story, but you never write a speech or a script.
No.
It always, so you're actually telling a different story every time, but
you're
it's
right.
coming from that same place.
Yeah, it's coming right from my heart.
Yeah.
If I did it with an outline, you wouldn't want me to speak.
It wouldn't have the same impact.
No.
No.
And, you know, life experiences allow me to speak to different things every time I speak.
Mm-hmm.
But even more important than that, it's never about me when I go to speak, Rennell.
Of course.
It's always about the people that I'm speaking with.
Of course.
Because it's their stories that I want to engage with. So whether it's a church or a corporation or a hospital or a nonprofit, anything in between that spectrum, it's always about understanding, first and foremost, what do they need? And then through my story, I hopefully am able to offer that to encourage them in their story. And that's really all I have done over the last 27 or 28 years. And it has been an incredible gift to me and Jan to be able to do that, to think that I'm just one person in this universe of some pretty amazing people with amazing stories. And I get the privilege of telling that story
yeah.
over and over and over again. That's why my message is, don't ever deny the significance of your story, whether it's in front of 5,000 people or five people or just one. That story is powerful, and it can make a difference in somebody's life who desperately needs it in that moment. And so that has just been one of the most amazing gifts that I've been given by God.
It must be so rewarding and so fulfilling after all that you have been through
yeah.
to be able to have that impact on other people. You know, Jackie Robinson is, you know, I idolize him, of course, and one of my favorite quotes of his is, you know, a life is not important but for the impact that it has on other lives.
Yeah.
And you have been living that every day.
I just watched the MLB piece on Jackie.
Yeah.
I'm reading a book about Jackie right now. I have so much admiration and respect for what he was able to do. I really do believe that he was God's man for a very important moment in history.
Oh, no question.
That would literally change the course of history.
He was chosen, no question.
And what he gave to all of us was a gift I hope none of us ever forget.
Yeah.
And there's still a lot more work to be done.
No question
about
it.
But he's given us the gift.
Yeah.
And I think that is really powerful. You know, the other thing that I'd like to just say is when the Giants offered me the opportunity to become a community ambassador, they do not know what that meant for me and my family.
Oh, really?
It has been one of the most precious gifts that anyone can receive. because what they allowed me to experience is to become a part of a family that I love with all my heart. Mm. And instead of it just being from the outside, now I get to experience it from the inside.
That's right.
So to you and to all the people that are a part of this, and anyone that listens to this, the San Francisco Giants are the most amazing organization in the world, because I get to love on people like you. Uh-huh. And all the people that I meet through that organization. Uh-huh. And be loved by you.
Uh-huh.
And that gift, we will never forget, never. Because I hope the fans in this community realize, I think they do, just how special the orange and black are.
Oh, they most certainly do, and they so understand. I hope you feel it whenever you're around us, how much you mean to us and to
are
the organization. How about that?
When I go to the ballpark, when I go into San Francisco, and all of a sudden I'm walking on the sidewalks and I hear, Dravecki! I'm like, oh my gosh, man, when I lived in Colorado, nobody said Dravecki. It was like, buddy, get out of the way! You know, so here I am in this incredible place where I will tell you, I'll be the honest retired guy who says, it's wonderful to be remembered.
There it is.
It's wonderful to be remembered, but it is amazing to be a Giant.
Well, thank you for this amazing conversation, and just bless you and Jan, and all my best to you and the family, and thank you for the gift that you've given so many of us, and thank you for your time today. As a matter of fact, I have something for you and Jan.
Well, before you do that, we need to cap this off with one of these.
I'll drink to that, Dave Dravecki. Thank you so
Here's
much.
Here's to Rennell.
Here's to Dave. Thank you so much for this. This has been wonderful. Cheers, everyone.
Mm.